Hey, everybody. My name is Vinay Shaw, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. Hi, y'all. I have been in this awesome, magnificent fellowship of ours since February the 7th of 1969. I came into the Central Group in Lubbock, Texas, which was my home group for many years. I now am at Los Angeles. It says Marina Del Rey, but, you know, it's all one big old glob of cars and people. And my home group is the Stepped Up Group. We meet on Monday nights and Thursday nights. We're right by the airport. So if you're ever in L.A., and I mean this sincerely, give us a call and we'll come get you and take you to the best meeting that you will ever attend of Al-Anon anywhere. I have a committed open AA meeting that I go to every Wednesday night. It's called the Pacific Group. It's over in Bel Air, and we will take you there. My sponsor is Pat Clater from Austin, Texas. She's been in the program for 41 years. She's still doing the things that she taught me to do and expects me to still do them. So that's my credentials, and plus I have a plethora of alcoholics in my life, and three major ones and a bunch of minor ones in between, and just so I won't get lonesome, I birthed some of my own. So, I love alcoholics. I love alcoholics. Prefer them sober. I learned a long time ago that there was no blame here. My sponsor said that I was like I always was a squirrel looking for a tree to climb up, and alcoholism just fits me. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, truly, for inviting me. I don't take it lightly, stand behind these podiums. When I first started doing it, I thought it was cute, and my head blew up, you know, and all that kind of stuff, but as the years have passed, I realized that this is holy ground for me, and I treat it as such. I think my even arriving here was a divine appointment, and I try to keep it just that way. So, committee, thank you very much. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for saving my family's life. And I got a bunch of them that y'all are saving. And thank you, Al-Anon, for my own. Those of you who showed up, I thank you. I really mean that. Not just for me, Vinay, but I'm sure glad you're here, but as to come here an Al-Anon speaker. Murph mentioned it yesterday, and I find it true, too. There seems to be, from time to time across the country, this, you know, yang-yang between AA and Al-Anons and not getting along. And I think it's contempt prior to investigation, my own self. yeah. Because right this moment, I represent your grandma, your mother, your sister, your wife, maybe your daughter, maybe your granddaughters, maybe your nieces, maybe your girlfriend, significant other, whatever. I represent them right this moment because I can tell you why they're so nuts. You know, one of our books, and I don't want to get into that, but one of our books that we used to have had a line in there that I just love. And it said, alcoholics are known to marry some of the meanest women in the world. For some reason or other, those that have the power took that out. And I've had a great time here. I truly have. The trip here is one of those trips that I would really bore you with because it's a long, dreary, you know, one of those trips. And I got here, and these three people have picked me up, Carol and Madeline and Karen. And, I mean, they grabbed me by the coat collar, and they hadn't let me go since. I mean, we got to go this meeting. We got to go this meeting. We got to go this meeting. Y'all grind it out here, don't you? Lord, you're getting every penny of my plane ticket, I'll tell you that. Trying to get in my room has been a challenge. I've had to go down the front twice with my key and have it read. I mean, it's just hysterical. I've kind of learned it. You got to put it in the little slot, and when the green light comes on, you got to pull, shove, shove. Pull, shove, shove. Pull, puff, shove. And about the fourth or fifth time, I make it in that booger. I mean, it's hysterical. I've never come across anything like it. I guess I better tell you about the ketchup story. We were having lunch in this magnificent restaurant here attached to the hotel. And some of you have been there. And Shay ordered a hamburger, and they brought out some. She had to go back and get some ketchup, and this speedy waitress gave her the ketchup. She came back, and she sat down, and she opened the ketchup, and she didn't get it all the way open even, and it exploded all over me. I mean, all over me and all over her. She put the top on really quick, and she set it out front, and we were just washing me off. And this one. She starts staring at that ketchup bottle. And I thought, you know what? She's going to pull that because she knows best. She's going to look at that ketchup bottle. And I just watched her, and in just a second, she pulled it over in front of her, and she just kept looking at it. Now, Shay and I are still wiping off the ketchup from us, but she's looking at that ketchup bottle. In a minute, here she goes. Splattered all over her, all over her. And then it started erupting like a volcano. I've never really seen anything like it. I mean, it just, I'm telling you the truth, it oozed up and all over the table, and she was just looking at it. Such a classic Al-Anon thing, I just wanted to get up. She could fix that ketchup bottle. She knew what her purpose was. She said was to smell it to see if it was bad. We call that dumb as a rock in my hometown. So I shall have tales of Maryland to take back home to the good folks, I'll tell you. And some of my dear friends are here that have helped me along the way, and I love them a lot, and it's really good, totally good to be here. And I changed the podium. I guess y'all noticed that. I gave him a heart attack. Well, we don't ever put the table over there. And I said, well, it's my turn and you're gonna. We'll move it back for those of you who get nervous about things like that. Well, I had a mama and a daddy. My daddy was a part Indian from Oklahoma. My mama was from a divorced family when that absolutely did not happen. Plus, they were Baptist and from the Bible Belt. And they met and married and had me and three brothers. And Daddy got a little used furniture business and was going along good. And then they'd take a vacation. My brother broke his neck, my oldest brother. And it just wrecked our lives from that time to this day. Our lives were never the same. My daddy went broke. People helped us from the community. We had to take a lot of charity. That affected me deeply because I was young enough to see that people were having to give us stuff. The church came and tried to help us, and I got a lot of misconceptions about the church because of what was going on. They brought in food and money, and my mother sat down and started just bawling her eyes out. And my daddy took this gray-looking face, and he went out in the backyard. And to me, and some woman almost smothered me, you know, hugging me, telling me Jesus loved me. It was like, this is not a good thing. These people aren't good things. They're bringing tears and sadness and smothering me. And I didn't want any part of that. And shortly thereafter, some other people came, and they put my brother, who was totally paralyzed, on a mattress and put him in the floor, and they all got around him and started praying over him and hollering and screaming and hands up in the air and just moaning and falling over. And it was just terrifying to me. I was just a little kid. And when they left, I went in to see if my brother was all right, and I can remember this so clearly. My brother said, they just did a prayer thing for me, and I'm going to be healed, and the first thing I'm going to do is chase you around the backyard. Well, I was just thrilled to death, so I went in the living room, sat down on the couch, and waited. And, of course, nothing ever happened. So there was no God, there was no Jesus, and whatever they were talking about certainly didn't work. So I just marked that off as something that's not for my life. I was tall and skinny and used to be haughty. I used to be a hottie, let me tell you. Sure slipped away. But the older girls, I think they were like 17 maybe. They took me out to my first honky-tonk. It was called the Cotton Club. And I'd heard about those places. And I was kind of frightened at first. I didn't know for sure if I should go or not. And I went in. And the minute I went in, it was absolutely, positively okay. The minute that I went into my first honky-tonk, my life changed again. You know those moments? That guy that's on TV, what's his name? Dr. Phil, he says there's 10 defining moments in your life. Well, let me tell you, that was the biggest of the 10. I walked in there, and the music was loud, and the smells were very familiar, and, it stunk. You know how they smell, old urine and old puke and old cigarette smoke, and it was just like my house because my brother, And I just fell in love with it. I just did, and it was just exciting. You know, the first time I ever went to a convention, it was the Midwinter Convention in Midland, Texas. And I walked into a room much like this, and they had crystals like that, which I'd never seen. And it was just like it is here, except they didn't kill you with the smoke when you came in. I love smoke-free environments, and everybody stands out, and you have to walk through the smoke to get to the smoke-free environment. And it was just exciting. People were up, and they were talking, and there was clicking and clacking. There was something going on, and I remember that distinctly, too. That was another life-changing time for me, I suppose. But it was the excitement. I craved excitement. There's a man in Dallas that he had this meeting. This always just reminds me of us. He had this meeting, and it was an AA meeting, a roundtable discussion. And the topic was, what do you think makes up the disease of alcoholism? And they all went around the table and said all sorts of different things, what we call the isms of alcoholism. And when he got back to him, he said, isn't it strange nobody mentioned alcohol? And if you talk about Al-Anon isms, all the things that make us up, one of them being addicted to excitement, isn't it strange that most of the time we never mention alcohol either? We're talking about him. It's a him that's going to fix us. And that's what I discovered out there. There was excitement out there. It was a land of this ain't real. And I loved it. The alcoholics would sit over on the bar. And the Al-Anons, untreated Al-Anons, us, would be on the other side of the room watching them. And it was just, for me, it was like a smorgasbord. I mean, they were just over there on those stools, and about 11-ish, they start coming off the stools, and you start dancing, and you start picking them up, and you start these dreams. Oh, man, I had a lot of dreams. My dreams were I was going to get married. I was going to have 2 children. I was going to have a station wagon with wood on the side of it, because Rock Hudson always bought his wife a station wagon with wood on the side. I'm so glad to see some people who know who Rock Hudson is. Doris Day always looked beautiful. In the morning she woke up, and the only thing that was must was this little piece of hair, and everything else was just gorgeous. She was beautiful, and she'd get up and run down in this real frothy-looking housecoat and fix orange juice for the children. And there'd be this huge white dog with all this fur. He'd come running in, and she'd pat him and go get the, you know, the paper for her husband. And it was just, it was a dream, and I had that. I sat in those old dark movie theaters for years, dreaming the dreams. This is what's going to happen to me. So I go out in the honky-tonk, and I'm looking for Rock. Thank God I never found him. And I lost my dreams at that same exciting place. I lost every dream that I had because I discovered there's some prices that, as a female, that you have to pay to get the him. And I paid those prices over and over and over and over. As I lovingly call myself, I just became a good old slut puppy hoe, you know? Just, I would help you if you would help me, you know? And then, you know, when you wake up in the morning, there's nothing slippery as a sober alcoholic with a hangover. I mean, they are so slippery. They're gone before you can make any excuses to keep them. And one more sliver of self-worth went. One more sliver of my dignity went. One more sliver of hope. One more sliver of those dreams. They were just all dashed out there in those places. And I began feeling like a piece of garbage. I knew I was. I allowed myself to be treated that way, treated my own self that way, started being around people who fit that level that I had my own self taken me to. Nobody else took me there. And that's where I met my first major alcoholic. He was a professional gambler and a bootlegger, amongst other things. And the people that he was associated with were, they called them boosters. I don't know if they still call them that, but they called them boosters, which is a professional thief. You could order something, and they would go get it and bring it to you for a price. And they stole things and ship them out to California or ship them here to Maryland. I mean, it was just a little underground world that would come through, and these are the people he knew, actually introduced me to, and I believe that this guy was a professional hitman. We had a house out in the country, and with all the booze hid out in the cotton patch. And all during the night, there'd be people coming in and out. And unbeknownst to me, they were just some of the most, you know, what do you say? The scourge of society came in and out of that little house. We came in one night, and there was blood all over everywhere. I mean, everywhere. Down the hall, in the bathroom, and then I noticed little holes in the wall. There was a couple staying with us, and she was a prostitute, and he was her pimp, and they were in the other bedroom, and he'd gotten really drunk and started shooting at her and missed her all the time, and then he caught her and evidently pistol-whipped her, and I was just absolutely terrified. And this man that my first major alcoholic looked at me, and he said, "It's no big deal. He's just drunk. And he went in and got the pistol out from under his pillow, and he went to bed. And I sat up on the side of the bed rest of the night, wondering, what in the world am I doing here? How did I get to this? What's happened to me? And I sat there all night till dawn. And I decided that I'd leave. And it was just days later that I discovered I was pregnant with this man. And then there was no place to leave. My folks, when I had to tell them, were most disappointed. In fact, Merp talked a lot about mamas last night, I'll tell you, or yesterday. My mama, her disdain for me from many years was just unbelievable. And I remember the look as she had as she walked out of the living room. He kept me until I had my daughter, Tracy, and when I had her, he said, "I've done all I can do for you, and it's time for y'all to leave." And so I had to leave and went to stay with a friend. And it was so overwhelming to me. Some of the stuff that comes in, pops into your life, popped in at that time. Al-Anonism, one of the things is vindictiveness. Now, I didn't know that. I didn't know it was vindictiveness. I thought it was explaining to you how bad you've hurt me. Let me do something to you that you're not going to like so that you will see how much pain I'm in. So I went to the other side of town to some of my other great friends and picked a guy that he absolutely hated, who was also an alcoholic I know today, and who was easily manipulated, another Al-Anon-ism, by me. He had he'd been my friend and wanted to be more for many, many years, and so I used that to manipulate him. I took him to a place called the Bloody Bucket. That's a place that opens up at 2. And that's where Donnie hung out. That's where that was his hood, I think they call it today. And so I took this young man and helped him get drunk. This is something I did for years and years. Didn't really even dawn on me until I've been in the program many years. I would mix their drinks for them. Instead of an ounce of whiskey and 6 of water, I would switch it to get them, after they've had a few drinks, to get it going. Because once they were really drunk, I could manipulate them much easier. So I did that and got him to go to the Bloody Bucket, which he never went. And it was to show Donnie that I had this man and see what you have lost and make him jealous. That was the only reason I did it. And a couple of days later, he took a shotgun and blew that man's head off. I never, ever, ever expected that to happen. Not ever. That stuff happens in the movies. It doesn't happen in real life, and especially in Lubbock County, for pity's sakes, you know. But it happened. My friend Juanita came, and she told me about it, and it was early in the morning, and she knocked on the door, and the sun was just coming up, and she told me what happened. And there was something that happened to me. My chest started just absolutely closing down. My throat, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't swallow. The pain was just absolutely engulfing me at that moment. And everything started turning kind of dark and black. And I remember thinking, golly, the sun's going back down. How strange. And then this pain was so terrible that I instantly made a decision, I shall not feel this. Another little Al-Anon trick. Denial, I think we call it. And I just, boom, that pain went away. I put my shoulders back. I said, well, that's too bad. And I buried that so deep in me that it was many, many years in this fellowship and program and with a sponsor that I could ever pull that back up. I went to my mother's a few days later at my parents' house, and my mother said to me, we don't want you coming in and out here anymore. Don't want the neighbors seeing you. Because this was splashed all over the radio and the newspapers, and everybody knew that I was involved, and it was awful. And she said, if anybody asks for our daughter, if you're our daughter, just please tell them that you're not. And I said, of course, Mama. And I understood that. It didn't really hurt my feelings. I just knew that was a fact. That's what I should do. I should not go to these decent people, and I shouldn't be associated with them. And I had hurt them and disappointed them over and over and over, and this was just the classic. To discover later that my mother's, the only thing that she really loved and got to do was go to a place called the Rebecca Lodge. It was her only outlet for my brother. She had to tend to him all the time. And she had been elected a state office in this lodge, and it was really a big deal for her. And after my shenanigans, they asked her to step down, and she did. And it just did her in. So I'm thinking, I've got to find a better way to live. This is not it. This is terrible. This is horrible. And as I said, I had no God to turn to. I just need to change. I just need to feel decent. I had to do something. So what I decided to do was go up the rodeo grounds. It was in that time when people were burning the flags, and I guess that was that Vietnam or when it was, but cowboys did not burn the flag, and everybody in my part of the country, which was cowboy country, knew that, and they were respectable, decent people. And I went to the rodeos, and the announcer would say, we honor this flag, and everybody would stand up, and the cowboys would put their hats on their, you know, their hearts, and it was just very touching. And I thought, this is it. This is it. I'll get one of these cowboys, and it'll work for me. So I went to where they go, which is a piece of concrete beside the rodeo grounds with a fence around it and a band at the end. And all the cowboys lean up against this fence, and all the cowgirls lean up this fence. And about 11-ish, they start staggering over here. And I'd get a cowboy. My friend Jim Williams used to say, if you lined up 10 pretty girls against the wall, he would choose the sickest one every time. And I said to him one time, Jim, you have never figured out. You don't choose them. The sickest one takes one step forward. And I believe that's what we do. There's not one alcoholic that chose me. I chose them. I looked them over to see what kind of potential they had. To see what they could do for me. I wanted the one that was the most exciting. I wanted the one that most people were around. I wanted the one that would fix me the most, the quickest. And that's what I chose. So I got this cowboy. And we started swinging around that dance floor. And one night, he was really drunk. He was poking me in the chest about something. I picked up a beer bottle, one of those. It was a quart brown beer bottle, almost empty. And just laid upside his head. And he fell to his knees, and I started running. Now, that was a way of life for me. Fighting and scratching and cussing and yelling. I had the mouth of a woman that you can imagine that hung around the bars. I wore the clothes of a woman who was hanging around the bars looking for a man. And I was beat up. If you didn't hear the Alteen speaker yesterday, I hurt for you. She was absolutely magnificent. I always think that the Alteen speakers usually make the best talk of the whole convention, and I think it was that way this weekend. This young girl's talking about turning her life over to the man as she understands him, and he winds up nearly choking her to death and somebody having to rescue her. And boy, that was me. You know, when you have no self-worth, when you feel like garbage, when you don't know where you're going in this life, and you have no heroes in your life, this is what you do to yourself. You just let yourself be beat up. If you're like Shay and I, we just feel guilty. So, you know, you can't say anything because you're guilty. Now, I never knew exactly what I was guilty of. I was just guilty. So the beatings and all that never bothered me. And taking a quart bottle and whopping up somebody beside the head was just a natural thing for me to do. I ran out the door, and he caught me and swung me around. He said, you know what? I think you've just knocked some sense into me. I think we should get married. Now, don't think that idea just popped into his head, you know. I don't know who he was talking to or where that came from, because he was not the marrying type. I don't know how that happened. But I heard those words. Do you hear what I heard? Married. Now, married, that means you're a decent person because somebody's going to marry you. I never thought that. I never expected that the gangster to marry me. Why should he? It never occurred to me to say to him, we need to get married so this child will have a good start in life so she won't be branded for the rest of her life. We need to take care of this child no matter what you and I do. Let's do the decent and the right thing. Never occurred to me to say that to him because I knew he wouldn't. What would I even ask for? So when this cowboy said married, man, married. I could not hardly stand it. He loves salty dogs. And I kept a big gallon of salty dogs mixed for him for the next 3 days until we were married at my friend's yard. And the dream came. Here comes the dream. Here it comes back. I am going to be married. Now he's going to mow the yard. I'm going to bake some cookies, and I will make some kitchen curtains for the window. That was my dream. We didn't have a yard. I don't like to bake, and I don't know how to sew. But But this is my dream. This is a dream that I think is going to make life well. And we had a great marriage for the first 6 days, you know? I was just the cutest thing. I had all these great ideas, and I would really make life wonderful for him. I'd make him a sandwich and put a little note in there about the dreams. His dreams were going to come true when he come home at night. And I would, you know, have a bubble bath for him, scrub his back. I mean, I bake and cook. Oh, man, I cook chicken fried steak and gravy and mashed taters and green beans and pecan pie. You notice I said it correctly. Yankees. And I fix him his breakfast. It would be pork chops and eggs and biscuits and gravy and homemade jelly. And, you know, just the whole thing. And I just wanted to wrap him up and make him so okay. And then it was great for those first 6 days. And then he went out with Charlie. And I got my position at the window. And here we go. I would go hunt him down. I remember going in and kicking tables over, you know, in a bar. Just kicking a table over, screaming, yelling. Walk in, catch him on the dance floor. Poor, some unexpected young girl didn't know what was happening. All of a sudden, I'd grab some of her hair and sling her off and take a chair and knock him down. You know, don't I look cute, you know. This was my madness. This was my madness. Had nothing to do with him. I was just sitting and waiting. My life was slipping away. That dream was slipping away. My life was going. I had to do something. I had to do. Do you hear me? I have to make this work. Because if this doesn't work, I will disintegrate. I will fall into some imaginary hole and never come back out. And I don't know where I got all that, except it was my sickness. I decided that we needed a son. If he had a son, life would be wonderful. So I arranged that, and I have the most handsome young man. He's tall, and he's got blonde, curly hair. Well, some of it's, he's losing some of it, but he is the most handsome young man, and he's a cowboy. He lives in Indiana. He's a grown man today. And I had this cute little blonde boy, and I thought, this will do it. And it did keep him for a little while, not long. Pretty soon he was putting him on little calves that they call bulls, you know, and I'm setting up the grandstand, and all of a sudden I recognize my son out on a bull. I'm down over the chutes into the arena grabbing my son, chasing him. Can you imagine the madness that I must look like? He's on a bull just riding. He's having a time of his life, and I is his mother. Get off the bull! Get off the bull! Madness. And then people grabbing me and pulling me out of the arena. It was crazy. I saw nothing wrong with that. I was trying to get my kid. And then the drinking, you know, the drinking progressed, and I progressed, and, you know, the hideousness of this disease, it just takes over. I got sicker and sicker. I do not know why I am the way I am. I don't want to be. I don't want to criticize you all the time. I don't want to tell you how to do everything that you already know what to do. I don't want to be at your just nanny. I don't want to do that. I would give anything in this world if for a few minutes, I'm not sure I'd want it all the time, but just for a few minutes, I would have the sensitivity that I see my kids and my husband and many of you for one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. That sensitivity and that love between two drunks is the most incredible thing I've ever seen. There's one of my favorite things at the Pacific Group on Wednesday night. And the Pacific Group has usually 1,000 to 1,200 people every Wednesday night. And there would be someone new get up behind the podium to read, and they can't read. And they're stumbling, and they're, you know. And everybody in the room, I can just feel it. They just lean forward in their chairs, and they're just wishing them and loving them and helping them get through that reading. And when they finally do, they're just so embarrassed. They're just humiliated, and they finally, you know, you can just see the, oh, God, I got through that. And then the room just erupts. And they come down from that podium grinning and their eyes twinkling. And it's one of my favorite times in an AA meeting is to watch the alcoholics love and support each other. And to see my son, these folks here on the front row, they all know my son, Jim Jr., and he's helping their son, and it's so incredible. He brought me this young man a couple of weeks ago and introduced me to him. Not their son, but another guy. He picked him up in front of a bar. And he was just standing, no, it was a liquor store. He was standing in front of the liquor store trying to decide whether to go in or not. And Jimmy saw him, and he knew this guy because he used to drink with him. And he just pulled up and said, "Get in." And he brought him to the meeting that night, and he just looked pitiful. And one of the things that he wanted to do was introduce him to his mom. You know, what a treasure. And the look that I looked up and I saw the look that Jimmy had for this stinking drunk. And it just amazed me. I thought, man, I wish I could do that. Now, don't take me wrong. I love Al-Anons and new ones. You know, I just love them. But not to the depth that I see that there is in this world. I don't have it. I wish I did. I wish I could get there. But I can't. There's something in my heart that protects me. It's always been there, and I assume it's always going to be there. I am protected from whatever. Every now and then, I chip away at it, you know, just chip away at it, chip away at it. One of my friends, he was a sober alcoholic, and I was bawling over some man, who knows who, a long time ago. And he said the sweetest thing to me that really, I love what he said to me. He said, "You know, I'm just so grateful for every man that you have ever had in your life." What do you mean by that? You know, I'm just looking at him, just sobbing. I thought, well, that's crazy. What do you mean? There's been so many men. He said, "Oh, no. Every man made you exactly what you are today." He said, "Your heart's been broken a lot of times, and it's got a lot of scars." He says, "You know, when you go to an antique store, those hearts are the ones that are really valuable. A new heart with nothing, hadn't been worn, hadn't been touched, just old cold heart, silver heart, is not worth anything. But a heart that's been broken and has scarred all over it is valuable, and people pay lots and lots of money for it." And I'm telling you, I stopped crying. I thought, well, he was just such a silver-tongued devil, I'll tell you. And I have not forgotten that. It changed me, one of those little moments in time that changed me. I have these two kids that are hurting more from me than they are the drunk. My daughter was 3 when I married that cowboy, and he was the only daddy she ever knew. And they would just hide from me. And I don't blame them, because my madness, if they said the wrong thing or looked the wrong way, my backhand would come up. There was a rage in here that I could not control for many, many years. Just a rage. And it would shine at the oddest moments, at the oddest times. I never knew exactly when, where, or how. So I had 2 frightened kids. I had neighbors that didn't speak to us. Everybody. I had 2 little friends left. One was an alcoholic, and the other was just a friend who also needed a place to stay if she ran away from her husband, because I'd run and stay at her house. Those 2 people were the only people left in my life. Everybody else, you know, after a while, nobody wants to talk to somebody like me, with black eyes on a constant basis, with just negativity coming out of their mouth, with hatred on their face, with black eyes just shooting hate, my sponsor said when I walked in this program. So people stayed away from me. My father would come by from time to time because he loved that little girl, and he would check on her. But nobody else would. I was sitting in a rocking chair one morning, and I thought, man, I wish I could commit suicide just for a little while, you know. Just get out of this. Just get out of it. I couldn't handle it anymore. It was the deepest and the darkest of the darkest days. And I had read in Ann Landers a few weeks prior to that about some woman talking about her drunk husband. And Ann Landers, what I remembered, said to call Alcoholics Anonymous. So at that moment, I got up and looked in the yellow pages and called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got a name and a number, and I called, and they said, "Come over." It was this woman. So I went over to her house. She was a sober member of AA. invited me into her home. And this is so silly, some of the things that you remember. We walked through the living room, the kitchen, back to a den, and I looked through the kitchen as we was going through, and it was sparkling clean. The sink was white and just sparkling, and there was this tablecloth and little flowers on the table. And I looked around, and I was thinking, I wonder where all her dishes are, because there was nothing in the sink. That thought went through, because at my house, anytime you need a dish, you went to the sink. I didn't have time to wash dishes. She talked to me for the longest time. I don't know why God chose this route for me to get here. I don't know. But I'm forever grateful. In a little while, her husband came in sober, member of AA, and he sat and talked to me for a long time. And as they were talking, this little thing happens, you know? This little spark. I think it's the music. You're starting to hear the music of AA. It's just this little spark that thought, well, maybe, just maybe. And they invited me to a meeting. They would pick me up, and they came, and they got me and took me to my first meeting. Two sober alcoholics, not Al-Anons, two sober alcoholics. And I opened he opened the door for me, and I walked in, and I saw two drunks at the end of this little long room with a cigarette machine, the kind that you used to put 25 cents in. pull, and you know, it would slide out, and all the little different kinds of cigarettes had their advertisement on there, and they were lights, and they were colored, and these beautiful lights were coming out of the cigarette machine. It was hitting their face, and they were both laughing, and I had not heard laughter in so long that I was just kind of stunned, and I just stood there in that door. You do not hear laughter in an alcoholic home. It's just not there. If an alcoholic tries to laugh, the Al-Anon's going to, you know, shock him up the jaw or something. I mean, there's just no laughter. And I remember hearing it, and it was crystal clear. And it just, again, that little sparkle, the music got a little louder, if you will. I went into the Al-Anon room and sat and listened to what they had to say, and I don't remember anything that they said. I don't have a clue what they said. I get so tickled in a meeting when somebody says, and they always do, I know you've heard it too, well, if they had done so and so when I was new, I would have left. Well, when you're new, you don't know nothing. When you're new, you don't hear nothing. When you're new, you're just sitting there like a bump on a log. You can't feel nothing, see nothing. You just sit there and look. I mean, if it was like that when I came, I would have left. Go where? Where are you going to go? Nobody wants us. I mean, nobody wanted me. And I left that meeting, and there was a little bit of hope that maybe there's some hope. I don't know what I heard. I couldn't tell you what I heard. I just knew it felt good to me inside my chest that hurt all the time for that hour. I just knew that, and I did want to come back. And so I started coming back and back and back and back. I like to describe it this way. There's a book called The Prophet by Cahil Gibran. And he says, say not that God is in your heart, but that you are in the heart of God. And I think that describes my Al-Anon meeting that day and to this day. I walked in and started going to those meetings and heard them saying words like sponsor and steps, and the steps were up on the wall like they are here, and they would read them. And which reminds me, at this convention, and actually two other conventions that I've been in the last few weeks, the people who get up here and read the 12 steps, three different times, the reader has chosen to change the words in the 12 steps. Please don't do that. Please, please don't do that. Please don't do that. Don't make this program to fit you. In your mind, sure, but don't share it. Because let me tell you, I got family members still out there that need this thing desperately. Please don't change it. It worked just fine before me and you walked in. I'll get off my bandstand there. And I saw these steps, and it was all confusing to me, and I would slip out. Just like Shay was saying, I think it was you. You know, you go right at the beginning of the meeting, you slip in, you sit in the back row, and as soon as it's over with, you get out real quick. before anybody will talk to you, because if they talk to me, they would realize who I was and what I was, and they would ask me to leave their meeting. And I wanted to be there worse than any place I'd ever been in my life. So I'd slip in and out. They caught me. There was two doors, and one got at one door, and one got the other door. They got out there before they said the Lord's Prayer, and this woman named Pat stood there and caught me. And she's this little tiny lady. And she had this disease, I still can't say it, but it's a bone disease. If they had to take some of her bone out of her eyebrow. And so it leaves like a point now. And she can cock her head and look at you in that point. It's like she's going to stab you with her eyes. And I am terrified of her. She's been my sponsor for 35 years. I'm still scared of her. And she said some things to me that only she could say and only I could hear. Again, a divine appointment, as I hear around here. And somehow or another, in the next few days, I made the statement that she was my sponsor. I didn't ask her. I made the statement because I was too terrified to ask her. And the very next day, she came to my work. And she said, "I want to thank you for trusting me." And she put a $10 bill in the palm of my hand and shook it, and we chit-chatted a minute, and she left. And I needed that $10. $10 back then was a lot of money. And I needed that because there was no food, and the electricity is about to be turned off, and I think it was $3.47 or something. You know what it was like back then. Boy, I make myself sound old, don't I? That's really not that old, but... Sidebar. When I went to pay her that $10 back, she said, "Oh, no, you pass that on. God will supply, and he multiplies our gifts." So I gave that $10 to a newcomer. It was just burning a hole in my pocket because somebody, my sponsor, gave it to me. I got to give it back. So I gave it to somebody, and he was like, "Sure, pay that back." And then it came back to me. I knew it was the $10. It came back to me in another way. Oh, crap. And I gave it away. Came back, and this time it was a 20, and I gave it away, and it kept coming back. And last time it came back to me, it was the amount of $10,000. That's just a true story. I'm not trying to be cute or funny. That's just a true story. And I always know when it comes from that $10. So it's still circulating around. She bought me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and gave it to me, and she said, "This is what we study and live by here. We have to know about the disease of alcoholism. So we're going to study this so you will know what you're dealing with. And then we'll go back through it for you to find out how to work the steps." And so that's what we did. Started my journey. I went through those steps with her. I got, at that time, the One Day at a Time book was just a few months old, actually, and we got that, and we studied it, and there was a couple other books that we studied that are no longer Al-Anon approved, and got me on my journey, and it's been such a journey. These 12 steps have changed my life, and I went through them many, many times, and of course, the first and foremost was they exactly like it says in the 12th step, I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And every time I've gone through them, the spiritual awakening has gotten bigger and broader and deeper. And I am just, this day, standing here, I am overpaid and overblessed, let me tell you. It's been a long way from that little shack that I lived in Lubbock County to Maryland this morning. I'd like to tell you about what happened to my family. I'm very aware of the time, and I know when we started, so I got a little note to keep it to an hour, so I'm going to try to do that. My family. That cowboy, he kept drinking. And for the first year. And I kept hoping he'd come. He did come. He got sober. He stayed sober 6 months, and he decided he wasn't really, really an alcoholic. And he left the fellowship. And for the next 7 years, I stayed with him, the last few years, in and out, in and out, in and out. It took me 7 years to get enough program and enough sanity. My friend told me this the other day, I just love it. I wasn't restored to sanity. I was introduced to sanity. I love that. And at the end of 7 years, he came in one night and he was, I could tell he's in a black eye. He was just crazed and his eyes were just almost rolled back in his head. And the minute I got into this fellowship, from the day I got in, which I came in with two black eyes, swollen nose, busted lip, from that day until 7 years later, he never laid another hand on me. I think one of it was prayer. One of the alcoholics suggests I keep my mouth shut. Isn't that amazing? And it just didn't happen. And this particular night, 7 years later, he came in and started beating me up. I got all tangled up in the sheets, so I fell over the foot of the bed, and my face hit the floor, and it made me just pop back up, look in the doorway. And there was my two children, screaming, tears. I'll never forget the look on their faces. And my little son, he was three, and he was just, his little legs was doing like that, screaming, "Daddy, don't hit her, Daddy, don't hit her, Daddy, don't hit her." And so help me, as God is my witness, that's the first time I saw my children's face. I thought, Jiminy crickets, these kids are terrified. These kids are hurting. Goodness sakes, what am I doing to these kids? And I got out of there and escaped, and I left him. And I did file for divorce. Now, one of the reasons that I had stayed is the as-soon-as syndrome. When you look at Al-Anons that are living with alcoholics that are still practicing, some of you look like I got looks with disdain. Why are you staying with that alcoholic? Why don't you get out? You know, da-da-da-da-da. It's a choice now. You have choices. And that's true. I did have choices. And I would tell you, I am leaving him as soon as I get the car paid off. I'm leaving. As soon as the kids get out of school, I'm definitely leaving. As soon as I get some money saved, I am definitely leaving. As soon as. And the truth is, I can no more tell you why I wouldn't leave than alcoholics tell me why they couldn't quit drinking. I don't know why I couldn't leave. I can't tell you that. It is because I am an Al-Anon. I am truly an Al-Anon, and I could not leave until it was time to leave. I couldn't. As the alcoholic cannot stop drinking until it's time to stop drinking. It's just that simple. I wish I could have done something about it, but I couldn't. So I left at 7 years. Now, I was a high school dropout. I had no way to support these two children, and I got into nursing school. And that's just one miracle after the miracle, and I don't have time to get into that. And I graduated from nursing school and went to work, and at that graduation was this whole front part here was just covered with my AA and Al-Anon family. My sponsor had moved to Austin and deserted me, I was quite sure. And she had flown in to surprise me, and she'd come walking down the hall aisle and sit down. And I was given the class response. They voted me. I was the old woman of the class. They gave me the pleasure and honor of giving the class response to families and friends that helped us get through school. And I was telling all these people how grateful I was personally in the whole class. And I looked down right in the middle of them was my mama and my daddy. And my daddy was doing the elbow to our next door neighbor, Mr. Stewart, and said, "That's my kid up there." And I, you know, those are the times and the moments that you cannot pay this fellowship back for. You just can't. They hadn't done anything different. I had been instructed to go to my parents and make amends to them individually and then to live out the amends. When my father, a few years later, got sick with cancer, I was the one that took care of him because I was the nurse. My brother had quit speaking to me, my next eldest brother, had quit speaking to me many, many years ago because I had a child out of wedlock and all that mess, and then turned around and got pregnant with Tracy. And he quit speaking to me and wouldn't have anything to do with me at all. And when my father was dying, because I was a nurse and because I knew what was happening, he came to me and asked me some questions about my dad and told me to do whatever, because he was very successful in the business. He said, "Whatever it takes for our daddy, you do it, and I'll take care of it financially." And that was the first words he'd spoken to me in many, many years. When my dad did die, my brother went to the school. He came in and he said, "I'll go get your children." And I said, "Thank you." And so he went to school and pulled my two kids out. And those were the only two kind things he did for me in 26 years. But I was able to take care of my dad because of that nursing, and I was able to have that contact with him. My daughter was, I think she was 15. And you know how you put your darling little girl to bed one night? She's just so darling, so precious, and you just love her. And the next morning she gets up, this maniac, teenage, witch, And I discovered she was drinking and sneaking and hiding, and boy, the fight was on. I tried everything in my power to stop her from being an alcoholic, and you just can't quite get there. And my terror was, I had heard so many sober women alcoholics from behind this podium where alcohol took them that I didn't want her to go there. And I tried everything to prevent that. And you can't. You can't stop alcoholism, no matter what. Shortly thereafter, my son disappeared, and I couldn't find him. And his drunk daddy had kidnapped him and took him off and hit him. And I was just frantic, and the police were looking for him. And it was just hideous. And I got this phone call a couple of days later, and he said, "I'm with my dad. I want to, and I'm going to live with him," and just hung up. He was 11. And the reason his dad came and got him is I had the principal of school had called me, and they'd caught him. The teacher had caught him sniffing Pam, that you cook with. For God's sakes, he was sniffing Pam, getting high on it. And I talking to him and realized that he'd been drinking and some little light wine and smoking a little dope. He was 11, right under my feet, and I didn't know it. So I was going to put him in a boy's ranch and move away from Lubbock so that I could stop him being an alcoholic. Do you hear me? He is not going to be an alcoholic. And his dad kidnapped him for that. And I went to my sponsor and just laid out on the floor. I was just devastated and took an inventory of my motherhood and realized that I really was a bad mother in a lot of areas. But I also was a really good mother in a lot of areas. And what I was fighting was alcoholism. And I'll tell you, I hate alcoholism with every fiber of my being. It has destroyed my family. I hate it. My problem is I love the alcoholic. That's why I have to go 3 meetings a week. That's why I have to answer the phone at 2 a.m. That's why I have to go to meetings. That's why I get on planes. That's why I do everything I do, is because I have to have y'all to help me distinguish between the alcoholism and the alcoholic. My daughter had run off, so I was single and by myself, and thank God and Greyhound, they were gone after a while, And I gave them up in prayer and meditation to God the best I could, and I knew that I could not do anything with these children. It was surrender at the depth that hurt so bad that your hair and your teeth hurt. But I had to give up my children to this disease to do as they want to. And there's a page in the One Day Time, July the 1st, that I absolutely live by, and everybody that I sponsor has July the 1st, and they live by it. And it says in there that, you just can't do anything about it. And if you have a practicing alcoholic, whatever they be, I invite you to read that page. It will really save your sanity. At least it did mine. So I was single and doing the deal and met this man from California. His name was Jim Shaw. Handsome, deep voice, bigger than life, big old guy, had lots of diamonds. That really got my attention. And after a very long, hideous courtship, I finally snared him. Got married and moved to California eventually. And while we were out there, all sorts of things happened. My daughter got sober. I had to move out of town for her to do it, but she got sober all by herself. His daughter gave us the call. She had a child out of wedlock like I did, and I had to peel him off the ceiling about his daughter. And she was drinking, and she was going to put this boy in a foster home, because that's all she knew, because she had grown up in a foster home due to her mother and her father's alcoholism. Sheila's mother died drunk, and her dad just didn't know how to take care of him. And his sponsor's Clancy, and Clancy told him to put him in a foster home that he didn't know how. He was just fresh sober. So that's how those kids grew up. And we sent for them, and they lived with us for quite some time, and she got sober, and she's still sober today. She has 19 years sober. She's married to this young man, a good young man. He doesn't need Al-Anon, though. His mother's an alcoholic. His brother's an alcoholic. His wife's an alcoholic. His son's an alcoholic, but he doesn't need Al-Anon. Thank you. And they have another little boy, which is just magnificent. And Jimmy Jr. was bad drunk, wouldn't come around us, wouldn't have anything to do with us whatsoever. And that really broke Jim's heart over and over and over. He tried to make a living amends to that was not accepted. And while we were in California, we had a great life. Jim and I had a great life. There was a few years there I didn't think he was going to make it, and I was going to leave him, and he was glad I was going to leave him. And they called us from Oregon, right in the middle of our worst time of our marriage, to come do a couples retreat. It was just hideous. Right before this, Jim's brother, his favorite brother, died. And 2 weeks later, my brother that I told you that didn't speak to me committed suicide, drunk. Never spoke to me, never forgave me. And just a few weeks after that funeral, I was at a convention. You know, there's so many people that are in your heart and in your life that you can never pay back. They change everything, your whole perspective. I was at this convention. I was just a crying mess. And talk about the forgiveness that I hoped that my brother and I would have achieved and would not. And Dick Martin. Are you awake, Dick? He sleeps a lot. Dick Martin walked up to me after that meeting. He said, "Benoy, your brother made amends to you. The best way that he knew how. He was tired of hurting people that he loved. And he knew that he could not get sober. And he did the best that he knew how. And that was just take yourself out." And that changed me right then and there. And I told my mom, I told my other brothers, two brothers. It changed me. Because my brother was a loving man. He took care of me when my older brother got his neck broken. My parents were gone a lot, and I was kind of shuffled here and there, and this brother took care of me, and then he turned his back on me. So it just changed my heart. Dick's wife, Peg, sponsors my daughter, Sheila. And how do you say thank you for, you know, saving your kids' sanity in your life? So we went to this couples retreat, and we decided to do this 10th step out of the AA's 12 and 12 because we'd done that before. And we did. And I don't know what happened to them, but it saved my marriage. Literally. And Jim and I got fixed. So the last few years of our marriage was great and wonderful. And we were doing extremely well. The business was going good. We bought a little place out in Palm Springs. We had a place in L.A. And we were going to retire early to Palm Springs and give the business to business partner. He's going to make this guy business manager partner and blah, blah, blah. And Jim said, "My shoulder hurts." And the next thing I knew, they would tell me he had cancer and he was dying. And he lived 3 months from that day. I went to try to get straightened out that business and discovered that apparently we had been embezzled and there was nothing left. Nothing. And it was a big fight with police and attorneys and everything else just to get the equipment. And I lost that home and just moved into a room with one of the girls that I sponsored. Just moved into a room and just stayed there like in the fetal position for a couple of years. Shortly after that, my stepdad of many years died that I just absolutely adored. And then my nephew was killed drunk on one of those rigs, oil rigs outside of Houston. And then a few months after that, my mother died. So I had 4 deaths in 11 months. And that sounds really bad, but it was like one day, and then the next day, and then the next day. You know, you just put one foot in front of them, breathing in and out. And I was carried so magnificently. That's where the $10,000 came in. People from all over the country, and the Pacific Group was anonymously given this big, huge check from the Pacific Group to bury my husband because there was no money to bury him. And when one of us is wounded, I mean, everybody else just picks you up and just carries you to till it's their turn. And then you can have the strength back and you can take them on their journey. And I was taken care of, and I'm still being taken care of. Every single day I'm being taken care of by this magnificent fellowship and God. And it overwhelms me. It overwhelms me. My daughter stayed sober for 10 years, and then she got drunk. She tried to commit suicide, and then she got drunk right after that. And, you know, I thought she was doing well. She looked like she was doing well. She was doing all the stuff. And that's why I know that this disease is so hideous. It is cunning, and it's baffling, and it's powerful. And it took her sobriety and took her back to the depths of alcoholism. And it's true what they say around here. Even if you're sober and you get drunk 10 years later, it's like you've been drinking for 10 years. And she was a mess. She got sober again and had 2.5 years sober. And she called me one day, and she asked me if I was sitting down. You don't want an alcoholic to ask if you're sitting down. And she said that she had just run off to Las Vegas and got married. And I said, to who? I didn't even know she was dating anybody. And it was this long, hairy-legged guy that I knew from Lubbock that she'd met at Christmas, and this was in May. And they'd run off and got married. And the reason she didn't tell me, because she knew I wouldn't approve, because the guy was in and out of penitentiaries, and he was, you know, a drug addict. He was a mess. And I said, well, are y'all going to... She was living in Phoenix at the time. I said, well, y'all going to live in Phoenix, or are you going to go back to Texas where he lives? And she said, well, we got to hurry up and get back to Texas before his parole officer finds out that he's out of state. So, you know, I knew it was on the wall. And sure enough, she got drank. She drank again shortly thereafter, a few months after. And she has now made a surrender that you can tell. You know, you can tell sometimes with surrender. She's got 5 years sober now. She's doing really well and engaged to a nice young man in the program. Jimmy Jr., he has 2 years of sobriety. After his daddy died, and he didn't show up at much of the funeral or much or anything. He was just too drunk and just hated his father. He hated him. And he did as much as he could do, and he laid it down. And last February, I had 35 years, and we had a party. I mean, it was a party. We celebrated my 35. My sponsor was ill at her 40, so we did 40 plus one for her. And it was a great time. And my kids had this thing made for me. It's a video, and it's like a book, and it turns pages. And it was, each one of the kids gave me a page. And Sheila put that without me, that there would be no family. She wouldn't have a family, and how grateful she was for me, my example. My daughter Tracy put on there that they ask at this work thing who you respected more than anybody that walked the planet. She said, it was so easy, Mom, it was you. My son said, I know that you helped so many people, young people, get their lives and get their mamas back. And I'm so proud of you. And Jim Jr., had given me a Mother's Day card. And it said, you know, I've had a lot of moms, so I haven't been very trustworthy, but I'm beginning to learn to trust you. He said, I wish that you had been my mom from the beginning. And I called him, and we discussed it. And I said, you know what? I may not have been there from the first, Jimmy, but I'll be there till the end. And he had that put on that page. You said you'd be to the end, and I'm counting on it. And that was from these four drunks, you know. My son, I think he pups a lot. And he's on his fourth or fifth herb, you know. But he seems to be happy and doing well. And my daughter's functioning, and Tracy's functioning, and Jimmy's functioning. And, you know, we're doing so good. I have a granddaughter that I'm convinced is untreated Al-Anon. My little grandson, Brad, that Sheila brought back and we helped raise, he just turned 21, and he had a shotgun wedding not too long ago, and I got this gorgeous little great-granddaughter, and Brad is an alcoholic. The beat goes on, and he's trying desperately to get sober, and he just can't. He just can't. Not yet. So I need for you to stay right where you are, because my kids are coming up. My grandkids are coming up, you know. I need you as much today as I ever have. There's so much more that I'd like to be able to tell you, and I just can't. The time's gone. But I you're my heartbeat. I dance to your music. You fulfilled my dreams. You give me dreams I didn't even know I wanted. I love it here. Whatever you ever need, whatever you need, I will do my best to help you get it, whatever it is, because you've done it for me. I am so overblessed and overpaid, I'm just embarrassed sometimes. There's a man named Bob White in my part of the country that I absolutely adored, and he was one of those alcoholics that could just hug you, and you know, you felt like everything in this world was okay. And he's one of those that I watched talk to other alcoholics and saw that love go through. And he talked at this convention, and unbeknownst to us and to him, it was his last talk. And he said, you know, we say the Lord's Prayer after every meeting. And he said, I challenge you to pray it, not just say it today. It starts off with our Father, and then it says the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. He said, if there's a king and it's our Father, that makes you and I a prince and a princess, child of the king. He said, claim your heritage and act like it and treat each other like royalty, because we are. Then he said, the power is in these rooms. It's in each other. We really have the power to give each other this love and this acceptance and build ourselves up. And he said, that's the power. And the glory is God. The glory is being here. The glory is the music that we dance to. It's the dreams come true. That's the glory. And I know who I am today and what my purpose is. I am Princess Benoit. I'm a child of the King. And y'all gave me that heritage. And forever will I be grateful. Thank you so much.